Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
All right, everybody. Got a guy with us this morning. This is going to be an interesting topic. Ryan Swanson has got a new book out called A Beautiful Game, A Beautiful Shame. And I'm really glad that your publicist reached out to us, Ryan. I'm glad to have you on the Inside College Soccer Podcast. How are you?
Doing great, Don. Yeah, I'm really glad to be here, chatting with you. Excited about the book. Enjoying summer. Just watched the Gold Cup, so glad to talk soccer.
Yeah, you seem for a professor. Did you play soccer growing up?
Yeah, I did. You know, I did the kind of youth soccer thing. I played probably from, 5 or 6 up until high school, at which time, I switched more to basketball. It was kind of my sport through high school and into college. And so always, loved it. And then now I've experienced it as a parent. I had kids kind of going through the youth soccer season system. And so that's been my experience.
Right. So did you grow up in New Mexico?
No, I moved around a bit. I was born in South Carolina, moved to Northern Colorado, then to Canada, then to California, then to Virginia. And then I went through graduate school in the Washington, D.C. area, and then became a professor at the University of New Mexico. So really showed up in the state in 2013, not knowing much at all about New Mexico, except for the fact that, Northern Colorado is kind of in the same part of the country. So I thought, all right, we were very excited to move back west, but just kind of set up root, camp here in 2013. And it's really become home for us and love the state and what it's about.
Now, I've traveled all over the U.S. and I've danced all in around New Mexico, but I've never been. I've got a lot of friends from New Mexico. I've had players that have played at New Mexico State. And but I've never been. I understand it's a very beautiful state, though.
Yeah, it is. It's a really beautiful state. It's interesting. It's an interesting place. It typically appears on the bottom of some of the lists that you want to be at the top of. So the state has its struggles over the years with poverty, education, child welfare, different things like that. But it's got a lot of federal government presence. So Sandia Labs are here. We've got a big Air Force base, Los Alamos. Obviously, for people who saw Oppenheimer recently, Los Alamos is a big part of our state infrastructure as well. But then there's just really the beautiful topography of it. About the top half of the state, is mountainous, trees. Albuquerque is kind of right at the middle point. And then from down there, you go kind of into real desert. So Albuquerque, where the University of New Mexico itself is, sits at Mile High. It's high desert. It's all sunshine. And so, soccer teams here that come to visit are probably sucking air a little bit, because it's high altitude, it's dry. So it's a really, it's a unique, beautiful place.
Yeah, no, for sure. And so for those of you that don't know, for our listeners, so the Lobos have a women's soccer team.
Yeah.
And yeah. Used to have one of the better soccer teams in the country. I Jeremy Fishbein, players uh-huh. lovingly called him Coach Fish, had made 11 NCAA appearances, which, look, for a mid-major, I mean, it's not a major university. It's not Notre Dame, and they don't have the money that Stanford has and that kind of thing. Really, the goal of every college soccer coach is to make it into the show, the tournament. That's the goal. It means you were top of your league. You won the conference tournament, and you made it. You made it in there. And then once you make it in, it's single elimination. So teams can make runs two and three games deep sometimes, even if they don't have the resources that some of the other schools have and some of the scholarship money that other school has. And I know that that University of New Mexico wasn't fully funded, at 9.9 scholarships, which was the limit at the time, and they were not fully funded. And he was working, Fish was working on a budget, trying to bring in the best players he could, and brought in a lot of local players. And one of the trends in college soccer now is to bring in players from overseas, young, almost professionals. And that wasn't the model that Fish was following. He brought in, he believed in the talent that New Mexico had. So, your book, tell us about your book. That kind of just sets the stage a little bit up to the point that your book kind of takes over in 2018.
You did a great job setting the scene. Like you said, the University of New Mexico still has a very strong women's program. Coach Heather, leads a strong squad every year that's made the tournament. And so that continues, and that's something that we really enjoy in this community. But yeah, the University of New Mexico had for many years had a really strong Division I men's team led by Coach Jeremy Fishbein. It's a team, like you said, that made it to the NCAA tournament 11 times, made it to the championship game versus Coach Sasso in Maryland in 2005, made it to the Final Four, the College Cup in 2013, and just been a really successful program. Like you said, a lot of local players, a lot of New Mexico players, but mixed in with international players as well. So it was really a really dynamic program that won a lot and was super visible in the state, the soccer scene. So by my count, they had about 20,000 children in camp during Fishbein's time. These summer camps that are offered, and these were held often in Albuquerque, but also in places like Gallup and Santa Fe, very rural state. And so the program had a really big presence, from the early 2000s until kind of when we pick up the story in the book in 2018. So that's the background. But let me kind of just set the scene in 2018. The University of New Mexico, like you said, is a mid-major. So its budget, athletic budget, is $40, $50 million. It's escalating now, like all mini budgets are, but and that's got to pay for a lot of things. And so first in the pecking order, as you would imagine, is football and then basketball and then women's basketball. But that doesn't really buy success. And so at the University of New Mexico, the men's soccer team, along with things like cross country and ski, had actually been the most successful in terms of winning, graduating students, those kinds of things. But money is always a problem at a school like the University of New Mexico. So budget issues had been around for years. The program often ran a small deficit each year. Those deficits kind of would be added up, and this debt was accumulating for the athletic department. And for those who, who don't work in universities, there's kind of the multiple accounting stories going on here, and I won't bore anyone with that. I'm not qualified to talk about that, but it's often, the university has this big multi-billion dollar budget, and then different departments are supposed to keep track of what they're spending, and so athletics kept spending more than it was supposed to. And so 2017, 2018, a variety of circumstances came together to kind of force a crisis. The school was under review by the state and by the Justice Department and a couple of other things, and athletic department debt became a bigger issue than it had been. Because up until that time, it's kind of this little problem that's just rolling along. Kind of just pushed down the board every year. But in 2018, it becomes this political hot potato. And so at that juncture, the first thing the Board of Regents did, universities typically, have a Board of Regents in charge. The first thing that the Board of the Regents did at the University of New Mexico, they said, why don't we just wipe away this debt? It's internal. Let's just wipe it off the balance sheet. Essentially, no one will ever know. But that created all of this backlash on campus. And what's interesting about college soccer is that it's played at a college, right? And so faculty and staff and athletes and coaches, there's all this kind of struggling back and forth, right? And so when the Board of Regents said, let's just wipe away the debt, the faculty kind of went crazy. And I'm on the faculty at the university, so I can say that sometimes faculty goes crazy, and we kind of did as a group. And so there was all this
Well,
back and
especially around
forth.
sports sometimes, Ryan,
Oh,
because
yeah.
look, I've been at four different universities, four different colleges, and there are faculty members that played sports, that understand sports, that are into it, that
Yeah.
support sports. And then there's faculty members who think that sports have no business and no place in an academic institution. They think
Yeah.
that they coach, they think that they teach at Stanford, you know, they treat it, they're very hoity-toity
Yep.
when it comes to sports. And again, not all, but there are those, and often those are some of the most vocal faculty members. I often joke that, you know, those are the ones who got thrown into the garbage can by the kid on the football team, and they just told they hate sports, they can't stand sports, they don't want it anywhere near a college campus. They make some professors even go out of their way to, you know, make sure that they really crack down. They're going to teach these athletes a lesson about you know, about academics and what's most important. And I'm not saying that's what's going on there, but I will bet you that there was a mix of faculty at New Mexico, because I've never been at a school where there wasn't a mix of that going on. So just so people understand, it's an internal fight that goes on with academic senate and those that have a voice on a campus. Am I correct there?
100%. Yeah, you said it well. By my, rough count, I think most universities it's kind of split in thirds. Like you said, there's a third that are pro. They either had positive athletic experiences themselves, or they have seen how motivated college athletes are. They're in.
Right.
And then there's the bottom third that, like you said, they are just out to cut the whole thing. There's very much this idea that we are a university, we shouldn't be doing this, we got to get rid of it, and there's usually a distorted sense of how much money is going to athletics, how much it's actually costing, what it's bringing in, but it doesn't
Right.
really matter. They just want to cut.
Well,
And
they
then the
would like
middle
that money
third.
in their program. They can't understand why they can't have that money, and why the Why does the football team deserve that? And why does the basketball team get that? We should be getting that money. This is an academic institution, is usually the argument that I hear.
They almost see it as a zero-sum game. Like, if the football team wasn't there,
Right.
the English department would get this money.
Right.
That's not at all true. But then, there's the middle third who's just like, whatever, I'm doing my job, the college,
Right.
so
Leave me
that, so
alone.
they're, yeah, leave me alone. Yeah. So that's pretty
Right.
universal. But at New Mexico, it kind of boiled over in 2018. And I won't kind of get into all the details, but at the end of a series of long meetings, the Board of Regents said, we have to cut soccer. In the after the 2018 season. So sports are cut at universities. It's always difficult. Essentially, what you're doing is saying to a group of athletes and coaches, we don't have a place for you here anymore. And sometimes there are good metrics behind it, and sometimes there aren't. But what was really strange about New Mexico's decision was the decision was made about this time in July. And so it was too late to kind of stop the train right away. And so they said, let's play out the coming year and then we'll cut the teams, everything officially next year. And so it was kind of a dead man walking situation that the University of New Mexico soccer team found itself in 2018. And I will say, Coach Fishbein is a legend in college soccer, and he
Yes.
never believed that that decision was final. And so he saw the season as a way to, yes, keep playing, but he was going to create a miracle politically, financially, the team would stay. And other people thought, well, maybe we'll just give him a proper goodbye. And so there's this tension in this season that plays out. And so that's what the book covers. I call it A Beautiful Shame, a very obvious play on the beautiful game. But it's about a college soccer team in peril.
So how did this work? Did he give you access to practices? Did you go to training sessions? Were you in meetings with the team? How closely were you embedded with the team during this season?
Yeah, so I make the analogy that essentially I was Trent Crim in what maybe that was season three of Ted Lasso or whatever, where he's embedded with the team and he's going to write a book. I'm a faculty member at the University of New Mexico, but I have worked with the athletic department for years, and so I know many of the athletes, know many of the coaches, and so when this happened, Coach Fishbein offered me full access. He said, why don't you just be with us as this is going on? He may have had some other, motives for that. So yes, I attended everything, every practice, every meeting. I traveled with the team. I often joke that I should really be into European soccer because I traveled to places like Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Birmingham, Alabama. And, they were not exotic places, but yeah, I traveled with the team, was in the locker rooms, in the locker room at halftime during games. And so I had complete access. And then along the way, I had a chance to sit down with almost everyone involved, all the players, administrators, coaches, soccer experts outside of the scene, and get kind of interviews about it. So it was a really, it was an amazing experience for me as an author to kind of get a firsthand look at what a college soccer team is like. Because it's been a long time since I've been part of a team. And so, on a real simple level, a college soccer team is an amazing place to be. And so I got to kind of watch that throughout this, 5 month period.
How did administration feel about you, especially your direct reports? How did they feel about you? How'd this work? How'd your classes work? How were you able to teach classes? And was there administration that was nervous about you following them around and interviewing other administrators and all of that? Were people nervous?
Sure. You bring it, it gives me a little tension even just thinking about it. But I mean, on the basic level, I continued. I always was able to work around my obligations as a professor, my responsibility. So, yeah, classes, I kept teaching, kept researching, those kinds of things. But yes, there was. It was a really contentious time at the university. Nobody wants to cut programs, right? The president was told by the Board of Regents, you have to do this. Kind of complicating things, a new president came in and a new athletic director came in and were told by this Board of Regents, you have to cut teams. So nobody wants to be doing it. And yeah, there was a fair bit of asking from my boss and upper, what's going on with this person? I followed all the procedures in terms of, kind of an internal review board. Why am I doing this? What's the research? What am I going to do with the data that I gather? So it was awkward and tense at times. But what I will say is no one from the university ever tried to stop me. No one closed the doors. No one said, you can't do this. Everybody kind of recognized that it was an awkward thing. I had some concerns, like, is this a smart thing to be doing career-wise? I am blessed with tenure. There was that kind of cover a little bit. But for the most part, I was like, people said you can do this if you want. And then after it was all over, our president, who had to kind of spearhead this move, even though, like I said, she came in and was told to do it, she sat down with me for a long interview. So I think in some ways it was a rather inspiring example of allowing an inquiry to happen, questioning to happen, data to be gathered, even though it made people uncomfortable. But that's kind of what a research university should be about. And so that's a long way around your question, but that's kind of how it played out.
No, that's good. And I believe that's exactly what it is. And that's what tenure should be about. This is the proper use of tenure, allowing professors to do their job and to speak their mind and do the research that they need to do within their field of study. And unfortunately, we aren't seeing that a lot at some universities across the country. We are seeing censorship and professors being shut down. So that says a lot for the University of New Mexico,
Yeah,
for sure.
I think it does. It was hard, but it was allowed. And so I went through the season, and initially, I had the experience. I wasn't exactly, the goal was to follow the team and gather the story as it was happening. I was never quite sure what I was going to do with it. And so after the season was over, I wrote a couple of short pieces for Top Drawer Soccer. To be honest, I just wanted to get something out quickly. The players had put up with me, and I just wanted to get something out there for them to see
Fair
right
enough.
away. And then I kind of sat on it. This was the season I covered was 2018. I wasn't sure what to do with it. Kind of fast forward to more recently, I had a publisher approach me and say, is this, did the book ever come out? Did you ever do this? And at that juncture, I looked and thought, you know what? That 2018 team was right on the beginning of this revolutionary period that we're experiencing in college athletics. It was right at the beginning of the transfer portal, right at the beginning of conference realignment, all this discussion about how we're going to pay for, athletes and rosters, how big should they be? You've already mentioned the 9.9 scholarships. So with that kind of context in mind, That's, I really kind of jumped back into the book and brought it to fruition, so that it just came out, last week.
Was this during COVID that you were approached, or at the end of COVID, or was it more recently than that?
Yeah. It was even more recently than that. It was really 20, 2023 when they, a publisher, we kind of came to terms. And ironically, it was right, or perhaps fittingly, it was right as the last player from the Lobo team was finishing up their eligibility. A couple of the red shirts on that 2018 Lobo team had left the university. They had had extra years because of COVID. And so, like November 2023, as I was like finalizing the book deal to do this, Ben Shepherd, among others, players, was playing his last season in college soccer. And so I thought that was good too. Like, all right, these guys have now moved on. I can kind of put this story out there without it affecting them in that way.
So how I don't know how easy it is for you to answer this because you weren't with the team, you weren't really following the team as closely in 2017 and 2016 and et cetera. But was there a season-long tension with the players knowing that this was it? And well, first question I guess is, was there a mass exodus of the players when they heard that that the program wouldn't be renewed? Did players jump ship immediately? Or
So I
because it
had
happened in
just
the
as
summer, were they kind of stuck, I would imagine.
well, so just a couple of things. I'd been fortunate to work with the soccer team for years because one of the things I was doing was running a program for high achieving athletes, and soccer athletes are high achieving in the classroom as well. So even though I hadn't been kind of embedded with the season, I knew many of the players, I knew all of the coaches kind of in the seasons leading up to it. But the decision was announced in July, and like you know the timing better than I do of kind of recruiting and coming in and all that kind of stuff. And so it created a real kind of crisis point. But right off the bat, seven or eight players did leave for other places. A couple of them quickly transferred and found spots in July. Three of them who had been on the fence about turning pro decided to join USL teams, and or a couple of them got homegrown contracts. So there was an exodus of a chunk of really firepower from the previous year's team. And so that was created kind of this instability heading into the season. But then the season played out, and to get kind of to the last part of your question, it was a push and pull the whole season between, all right, we've got Old Dominion University on Tuesday. Here are the tactics, here's the formation, here's how we want to play. And there's this like political rally going on. And so can you guys, do you want to play a part in that? And so it was really this push and pull between the game in front of you and this cause of saving the team. And I would say the players were involved in it to an extent, but I'd say they did a pretty good job of like, I got to keep my grades up. Hopefully we win some games, and then this other stuff with saving the team, like we'll do what we can. I think it was probably hardest for the coaches. They were, and especially Coach Fishbein, they were trying to both save the program and bring together this roster, which was really chaotic compared to the way it was usually put together. So it was a really tumultuous season, but the joy and the camaraderie of the team was really one of the subplots of the book too. So for those in your audience, who are either our players themselves or want to be college soccer players, I came in as this outside person. I knew many of the players, but I certainly hadn't been sitting in meetings. I wasn't like riding in the minivan on the way from the hotel, to a game before this time. And what I observed was this group of young men, 27 young men, and these four coaches. And I just got to see the kind of culture of college soccer, and it's a culture filled with, kind of traditions and rituals and joking around. There was a subplot for this team the whole year of trying just to keep track of 40 soccer balls. Like most programs, the University of New Mexico invests in a bunch of good soccer balls at the beginning of the year. And the problem is, soccer players can kick the ball a long ways. And so just even keeping track of where all the balls are became like, and that's the duty of the freshmen in the program at UNM. And that was even like a subplot. So, I observed a lot of it just with a smile on my face, even in the midst of all this kind of tumultuous activity.
Yeah, and this staff had been together for an unusually long time. I don't know what, 7 years, 8 years. The core of the staff. I mean, Kelly Altman, of course, is maybe the most famous coach coming out of it because he's been at some big time programs. He was at Dayton, and now he's at Florida, I think, University of
He's at
Florida
Florida.
on the women's side. And then I don't know what Brandon and Sava are doing now, but that staff had been around for a long time, which is, people laugh at the, how do I say this? The cynic, the cynics out there don't like it when coaches say we're family. And especially in the modern environment, the current environment we're at, because, I bring in as a player, I say, hey, be part of our family. Every coach uses that as a buzzword when recruiting. But then if you don't perform well, I kick you out of my family. If you don't do what I need you to do, I kick you out of the family, which that's not how families operate. If your kid brings home a B instead of an A, you don't kick them out of the house and never talk to them again. Or brings home a D or an F even. You don't kick them out of the house and say, I'll never talk to you again. If you're family. And but coaches are doing that. And but that wasn't Coach Fishbein's. It's never the way that he was. It wasn't, I don't know him nearly as well as you do, and I've got some very good friends who know him much better than I do. But when you see a program that's as storied as what the New Mexico men's program, I mean, it's a little like Akron. Where you have it's a state school for Pete's sake. It's not, like I say, it's not Notre Dame, right? It's a state school, and so when you see state schools beat out the big boys, beat out the Stanfords and beat out the Notre Dames, and make runs in the tournament as deep as he did, it's impressive. It's like, watching what Sasha's done at Maryland. It's impressive. And so to see a staff that's as tight as this staff was, I know that's a brotherhood. I know that they're really, really close. What did you notice about the staff and how they were handling this? Obviously they know they're gonna go get another job. I mean, that's so difficult
That
to
was the
spend a
tension.
whole year knowing that you're gonna be looking for a job.
I'm really glad you brought up the staff because being a kind of a part of the coaching staff, sitting in on meetings. Now, granted, I was an observer, but the staff during this critical season was Jeremy Fishbein, who had been, he's in his 17th year, 18th year at the University of New Mexico, long established kind of an institution in the state and college soccer. So he was at the top. The associate head coach that year was Mike Grazak, who's now at Notre Dame as an
Ah, got
assistant.
it.
And he had been there about 7 years. And so he was kind of in charge of tactics and, that kind of stuff. And then you mentioned Kelly Altman. He was there. He was the second assistant. And, he was in charge of, everything from kind of warm-ups to really facilitating the player's academic kind of journey. He was in charge of that. And then Lucas Champenois was the goalkeeping coach. He's now at, I think he's at North Carolina State. And so it was a dynamic coaching staff. And the back and forth between that group was like a family. I like that you said that, because it was tense at times, to be honest. Fish was just focused on saving the program. And Mike was often left to like, all right, what's the tactical game plan? And Kelly was the conduit and champ, as we were often referred to Lucas. They were the touch points with the players, on the everyday level. And so they all were trying to balance this, like, how do we look towards the future, but also take care of the game that's in front of us, and then think about, if these players have to transfer, for example, do we need to cut tape for them? Do we need to help them do this? Or is it not time for that yet? And so I loved watching the four coaches really work together. And Fishbein ran a high expectations program. One of the stories that Kelly told me, and you're right, Kelly's at Florida now on the women's side. When he first started with Fishbine, he had an experience where he was in charge of kind of monitoring the international recruit services. So there these lists would come up of players that are available, and I'm sure there are a bunch of these things. And so Fishbine said, "Hey, this guy looks good on the serve. Why don't you check him out?" And then Fishbine waited. They both went back to their second offices, and Fishbine waited like 2 minutes, emailed Kelly, "Hey, did you see this guy? Have you followed up on it?" Fishbine waited like one more minute, and then he called Kelly and said, "Hey, have you followed up on that guy?" So Fishbine just had these like constant expectations, high expectations. But what it did was drive the coaches and the players to really be ambitious, to go after it, to work hard. So yeah, I found it really convicting, to be honest, as a middle-aged adult observing this, like, wow, these guys are going after it, they're working hard, they're in this competitive environment. So observing the coaches, and I record a lot of that in the book. I think it'll be fun for some of your coaches to have an inside look at another staff, because obviously, the Fishbine tree includes people like Jamie Clark and others, who have gone on to run their own programs, and they probably do it slightly different. Of course, everybody does, but I think that DNA is still in there.
It is. It is. And now, as did when did Coach Fish finally realize that it was over?
Ooh, that'd be a good question for him. You should have him come talk to you at some point. But I would say it wasn't until the very end. So basically, his contract ran all the way through June of the following year, and he kept the fight up. And the New Mexico State Legislature meets in January, and initially, the state of New Mexico promised $2 million to bring back New Mexico soccer. And skiing was another program cut. And so he had been pretty successful in creating this political movement. Now, back and forth happened, and in the end, the university kind of said that we can't take this without more money. But he fought all the way through that spring after. And there was a really interesting argument that went on about whether a spring season should happen. Obviously now, maybe there's the possibility that the college soccer may be considering a 2 semester season. I know that's been a long discussion by, Coach Sasho and others, but so Fishbein argued that, well, should we still let exhibitions happen? The university said, nope, it's done. And so they kind of argued about that. But I would say he didn't fully believe until the day that he closed his office door. I think it was like June 30th at the end of his contract. He
So
walked
he was
out,
still
and
actively recruiting and
I think he had stopped recruiting so much, but he was
okay.
pushing for restoration of the program, and he was keeping in contact with players. He was keeping, so I mean, he was keeping it alive as long as he could, despite the fact that eventually the players who had been on the roster the year before had to commit to other universities and do that kind of thing. So he really fought until the very end to keep the program alive.
That's Folks, that's how you win. If you're a coach, that's how you win. You fight until there is no fight left to fight. And
Well, and
that's
he had,
why his program was what it was.
yeah, I mean, he had, in observing the team, he had had a bunch of mantras, but among them, he said things like play your nuts off, control the controllables, don't pass blame to others. And he had basically taken those, and that's how he fought the fight to keep the team, which made for awkward, exchanges sometimes. But he had fought to the end, to kind of keep the team with those same kinds of like charges that he sent his guys out onto the field with.
Yeah, well, I that's why, yeah, like I say, that's why he is the legend that he is. It's amazing to hear this from an insider, that's how he was working all the way to the end. Because a lot of coaches wouldn't. They wouldn't do
Yeah.
that. They would just take it, they would take their ball and they'd go home and they'd go start
Yeah.
looking for another job. And that, man, that hurts him. Look, the hi main hiring season for soccer coaches is starts in November and then goes through December, January, February, and then by March, most of the jobs are filled. Sometimes it'll go on to into April and May, but if a coach fights all the way till the end of their contract in June, the jobs are filled.
And I
That's
have it
it.
on.
So he kind of took himself out of the market of getting a job right away.
Yeah, and I have it on, I have good sourcing that suggests he had been offered interviews and opportunities to explore other positions during the season, to be honest, and then immediately after that, he just for the most part passed up as he kind of, really. And I think there was a conviction on his part that the state of New Mexico needs soccer, or deserves soccer. Soccer is by far the most popular sport at the youth level here in this state. We're a majority Hispanic population. The game is very popular. He was making the argument that yes, I could go coach elsewhere, but the state of New Mexico deserves this, and it's been built into something. Let's preserve it. So, every place is different, right? And I think the beautiful game in the state of New Mexico is a really passionate thing. And some of the things, that we've seen after that, the New Mexico United in the USL has led the league in attendance now here recently. And so there's a real passion that's kind of moved into that, which I always view with pride, to be honest. What they are doing as a USL team in our city is really amazing. But there's a hint of kind of sadness for me too, because part of it is like reallocating the passion that had existed for Lobo soccer kind of over to the USL scene. So there's a little bittersweetness there for me.
Was there how active was the fan base in trying to save soccer? Were there alumni that were coming to the games? Was there a fan base that was organized and trying to fundraise? Because I'm a little surprised that not too far from you guys is the University of Nevada at Las Vegas, and they came in and they basically cut all of the funding for men's soccer and told the staff that if they wanted to keep soccer, they could keep it, but they were going to have to fundraise everything. And Coach Rich Manning stepped in. And I know Las Vegas is a little different community. We've got some very wealthy, casino owners and stuff like that. And his fundraising campaigns are still legendary and are going. And my son's former college coach is there now. And they fundraise virtually all of their money. Was that even an option? Did anybody even offer that as an option?
It was not an option. The decision to cut men's soccer was not only budgetary, but it was wrapped into a Title IX discussion, which I could talk at length about. But
Talk
so
a little bit
basically,
about what you know about that.
yeah.
Because I
So
hear
what
this a
the
lot. I hear this a lot
yeah.
with Title IX, and I've served on Title IX committees, and I think I know a little more about Title IX than some people, but
Yeah.
probably not as much about Title IX as others. So
Yeah.
talk a little bit about
Yeah.
that.
Well, I mean, Title IX, of course, passed, more than 50 years ago, was meant to create an equal set of opportunities for female athletes as males, right? And so that has revolutionized American sports for the better. But where, among other places, it gets sticky for universities is the fact that most, FBS universities, Division I universities, have an 85-person football squad with 85 full scholarships. And so balancing the numbers that need to be had by an athletic department are difficult. And there are a couple of prongs, in order to stay in Title IX compliance. One of them is the idea that if a school has 50% male, 50% female, there should be roughly 50% male athletes, roughly, 50% female athletes. The challenge, among other things, that's coming with that is most universities have skewed female. So University of New Mexico, for example, is roughly 58-42. So then, therefore, you should have roughly 58% of your athletes as female athletes. The University of New Mexico did not have that when it kind of came upon this crisis in 2018. It still
So was
doesn't.
that the prong, not to interrupt you, but was that the prong? So there's three different prongs to Title IX
Yeah.
for those that don't understand. Was that the prong that the university chose to follow? Because the other one is interest. If you have 51% of your female athletes, but only 30% are interested in sports, you don't
Yeah.
have to force go grab girls,
Yeah.
women off the street and go, you're forced to play a sport, or take the men and go, sorry, you're not allowed to play sports because. It because there is an interest part of it, right? If
Yeah.
in a university is not students aren't interested in playing sports, then the university isn't forced to follow that particular prong.
Yeah.
Am I
Well, there,
correct?
like you said, there's three prongs in terms of participation, and then there's a financial component that's separate. But the three
Right.
prongs are, yeah, you can either be in compliance by proportionality, like I mentioned, 50-50, if that's what it is, or you can be in compliance by showing improvement. So you've added a team, you've improved things, or you can do the third one is you can make the case that there's a lack of interest. And what the University of New Mexico said on that prong is basically that's not where we want to live. There's a lot of information out there that suggests that that female athletes are booming at the youth level and high school level, and so we don't want to live there by pretending that there is an interest. And I support that interpretation. So I think UNM basically said we need to make it through proportion, through equal numbers of, or proportional representation for the student body, or by improving. And they just said we don't have any money to have new teams. Therefore, the only way to get the numbers right is to cut men's programs and pad the rosters of the existing female teams. So, example, they expanded the track team to like 100 female athletes, hypothetically. So it was in the midst of kind of that Title IX discussion that was going on and budgetary discussion. So once the Board of Regents said we're cutting men's soccer, despite the fact that Coach Fischbein and a group of supporters, about 1,000 were on this list that was working, they had promises of pretty significant financial backing. And then the state came along and said, we'll give you money too. But ultimately, the university wasn't open to that because of the kind of dual budgetary Title IX component of it. So there's questions to be asked in terms of, was there room for the university to kind of back check and change without looking kind of weak? And so I think the administration had to struggle with that. Fischbein made a lot of noise, made a lot of enemies. And so in the end, I think the money may have been there to save the program, but it was decided that it couldn't be saved, for a variety of reasons, including Title IX.
Yeah, I'm not buying it. I've been in enough board meetings at enough universities, but yeah, I mean, once that decision's finally made, unless somebody from the legislature is going to jump in and figure out some way to save it, that then it's not happening.
It's a really interesting political. I mean, sports are inherently political. College sports are political. And so in a state like New Mexico, the state makes a direct appropriation to the university for athletics. And that doesn't happen, in some other states, but that happens. So then the politicians say, all right, we give you this money. Here's what, here are the strings attached. And so university officials are left to kind of struggle with, well, we want the money, but we need the autonomy. And so there is that kind of back and forth that goes on. But it became very complicated and very political, which some of which I cover in the book. The focus in the book is about this team and how they played, but I cover kind of some of the offshoots going forward and the Title IX component a bit, the political po component a bit, because I found it really all fascinating, and I didn't like the outcome, but I thought the story needed to be told.
Well, and I'm glad you did. I'm glad you were able to tell this story. And so where can people follow you? Where can they pick up the book? So a little bit on your background real quick. So your specialty as a professor where you teach is in history, sports history. You've
I would
got
say
quite a few books on sports history.
I probably teach primarily now in really a kind of a sports admin classes or sport management kinds of classes. So I have a PhD in history, quite a ways back now, but really most of my writing has been on the business and the impact of sports in America. So I've written several books, many articles on the topic. And what a blessing for me, right? Some people are out there curing cancer. I'm writing about sports. We all have our cross to bear. So I'm really fortunate, but that's my background that I brought to this story. So I've written a fair bit about sports before this. I continue to kind of work on projects around sports because I think it's important. Our society, sports, soccer has a really impactful role. I also think sports tell us a lot of things, right? It creates a lot of records, a lot of money involved, a lot of interesting actors are involved. And so anytime I write about sports, though, the goal is to tell a good story. So A Beautiful Shame, which is, you asked where it's available, it's on Amazon or Barnes and Noble, all kind of the places people can get books. It's meant to be a story. And for those, people who have read college sports book, one of my favorites, A couple of my favorites are Running with the Buffaloes, where somebody kind of was embedded with the championship-winning cross-country team at the University of Colorado. Another favorite is John Feinstein, A Season on the Brink, where he goes in with Bobby Knight, for those
Great book.
older listeners. And so my
Great
goal is to do
book.
something similar on the college soccer scene, because I don't think many of us have been inside a D1 soccer program. What's it like? What are the practices like? What's the vibe? And so that was probably the principal goal. Now there's all this kind of crisis around it, but and so that's I'm really happy with the way it turned out, and yeah, I love people to kind of get out there and share it, especially within the soccer community.
Have you read Among the Thugs?
So, I don't think so. What's that
It's
about?
a reporter that was embedded, it got himself embedded into the Manchester United
Yes.
thugs.
Yeah.
They're supporters. And if you haven't read, boy, that's such
Yes.
a great read. And
That's right.
he follows them all around Europe and drinks with them and just gets embedded with them and all
Yeah.
the lunacy that goes on with the fighting
Yeah.
it's crazy. No, there's
Yeah.
some good books out there on soccer.
Oh,
I
yeah.
used to teach a class called Society, Sports and Society,
Okay,
Sociology of Sports.
Yeah.
And it is so wild how when you get into what you teach and what you study and where you've how much sports are embedded and a reflection of what we're experiencing societally.
Yeah, I think so. I've taught similar classes, and I love to talk about sports and read about sports. I often think that sports usually, like you said, reflects. There are these moments where it is a change agent, but more so it's a mirror, right? It shows us kind of what's going on, what are we arguing about, what are we valuing. And then I think it brings joy. I think there's a lot of times you observe a team. I often sat like on the side of practice, or stood kind of off to the side and watched these guys, launching these, bending kicks, trying to catch the crossbar, right? Over and over. They're just doing it. Why? Because they love kicking the ball, a good strike. They've been doing it since they were kids, and it still matters, at 20 or whatever. So, I like that sports is a mix of, yeah, interesting ideas, and you can take an intellectual component to it, but there's a simple joy to it too. There's a real just human movement, kind of component to it, which I think is really lovely. So it was a fun project for me to be involved with.
Yeah, the other book that just came to mind is How Soccer Explains the World.
Oh yeah, I know that one well, yeah.
That's
Yeah.
just amazing because all of those listeners out there that want to pick up some books on
Yeah.
sociology and stuff, that one's phenomenal because it covers, the everything from the Jewish problem to
Yep.
anti-Semitism to people, the violence in society, to the economics of society. Just an amazing, amazing
Yeah.
book too.
Yeah. Yeah. Anytime I work on a project, I try to, get a huge stack of books. Now maybe on Kindle. It used to be the literal stack of, so, I
Right.
just, along the way, read every soccer book I could kind of get my hands on. And there are some, I read The Inverted Pyramid, trying to understand tactics, which was really fun. It was at that time, like, I was looking at UNM's and my kids were playing soccer. I'm like, oh, they're playing like a 10-1, or something, and so, that was great. I love Soccernomics. I think is, a really great one for kind of explaining the money. I really enjoyed more recently The Club, talking about the rise of the Premier League. So, soccer for a global world, I think, is what baseball used to be in the United States. It used to be like baseball got way more writing around it than did the other sports. I think football and basketball are catching up now, but there's just a lot of really great stories to read, in the world of sports.
Well, and you've got one of them. So again, the book is A Beautiful Shame. You can pick it up at any major booksellers, including Amazon. And I really appreciate you coming on with us, Ryan. Appreciate it very much.
And great, Don. Thanks for the conversation.
All right, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that. Before I let you go, there's a new product that we have available called GapYearSoccer.com. And if you'll go there, you'll see some opportunities for players to play in a gap year. So a gap year is a year that you take after high school and before college. Quite popular in Europe, Players have people have done this for years. Students have done this for years. They'll often travel Europe or travel the world, getting some experience, real world experience before they head off to college. So in soccer, it's becoming increasingly popular in that players need to mature a little bit. I know my own son did this. At 18 years old, graduated high school, probably wasn't quite ready to compete against 20, 21, 22-year-olds that are in college. So he took some time, went to Europe, played there, played in England, spent a little bit of time in Germany, and then back to England again. Basically, just trying to grow up, mature physically, emotionally, and tactically as a player, trying to understand the game at a better level from more experienced coaches than he had had here, and definitely a variety of different coaches that had played in the Premier League, coaches that had played in the Bundesliga, that had played at lower levels in England, got a little some coaching and a better understanding, and got to see a bigger variety of players that had been released from Arsenal or Newcastle and some of these big clubs, and it helped him as a player. It helped him mature. It helped him grow up, and it gave him, most importantly, some time to mature physically and to become ready to compete with the men that play college soccer and that are successful in college soccer. So at SR USA, we've known that this was a problem that young players have. Young men and young women too. And so we've formed partnerships with top level academies in Germany, in Spain, in England. And we've got some incredible opportunities for players to go overseas and play soccer for a year while they allow themselves to mature and as they learn the game and a culture. In a different environment. So gapyearsoccer.com, you go there, you can fill out an application. One of our experienced staff will get on the phone with you and talk you through the different opportunities, get to know you a little bit as a player, get to know your family and your family values, and try to figure out if we've got an opportunity for you that fits you well. And you get an opportunity to grow a little bit before you enter college soccer, which hopefully will lead to a greater success for you in college soccer. We've got dozens and dozens and dozens of clients that have done this, and it helped their college soccer careers. So gapyoursoccer.com, and we'll catch you on our next episode.